It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Tap water tastes different no matter where we are, but it could taste best from faucets in Columbus, Wisconsin. We learn about the city's new national distinction. But first, Wisconsin has fewer coal-burning power plants today than in the past, and utilities are planning to retire more plants in the next few years. As Joe Schultz reports, these closures are part of a move to reduce carbon emissions. They can also create new opportunities for development at former plant sites.
In 2021, the Dairyland Power Cooperative decommissioned its coal-burning power plant in Genoa. Last month, local officials and utility staff members watched from a nearby bluff as they used explosives to demolish it. A large smokestack crashes to the ground as smoke and dust rise from the remains. Leaders of the utility are still planning what's next for the site. Brent Ridge is the CEO of Dairyland.
We're going to be looking for economic development opportunities that could range from manufacturing all the way to another power-generating resource.
The Genoa plant isn't unique. The state had 13 large-scale coal plants in 2005. It had 7 as of 2020. That's according to the State Public Service Commission. 3 more are expected to come offline by 2026. Scientists say burning coal to generate electricity is a big contributor to climate change. Utilities say they're committed to reducing carbon emissions, but their goals are voluntary. They aren't mandated by state law. In 2022, both We Energies and Alliant pushed back plant retirements, citing supply chain issues for solar components. Environmental groups say it's imperative that utilities move away from coal as quickly as possible to mitigate the worst effects of climate change. Utilities have pledged to go carbon neutral by 2050.
If it wasn't important to our customers, it wouldn't be important to us. So we're not going fast enough for some of them. Some of them we're going probably too fast.
That's J.P. Brummond, an executive with Alliant Energy. The utility plans to take its Edgewater generating station in Sheboygan County offline next year. The site sits along Lake Michigan. Trains coming into its rail yard carry coal that will be burned to generate electricity. Inside, industrial piping lines many of the walls and ceilings. Operations manager Terry Dumez points to a diagram outlining the plant's layout and process for converting coal to electricity.
It's pulverized coal. It comes out basically like powder after it goes through the pulverizer. It just gets blown, transported with air.
The utility has had early discussions with local officials and hired a consultant to help come up with a plan for the site's future. Meanwhile, a former coal plant in southeast Wisconsin is expected to see new life in the coming years. We Energies tore down its plant in Pleasant Prairie in 2022. Last month, it sold the site to Nevada-based developer Dermody Properties. Dermody plans to convert the site into a 3-building industrial campus. Neil Driscoll is with the developer. He says the site's infrastructure factored into those plans.
It gives us really good opportunities to tap into the power that's in the area, which is a big factor and quite frankly is a growing one with everyone's interest in data centers.
A former Alliant Energy plant in Beloit has had a second life since it came offline in the 2010s. While the site once sounded like this, it now sounds like this. When the Blackhawk Generating Station closed, Beloit College saw opportunity in the century-old building. The college struck a deal in 2014, allowing it to convert the site into a fitness and student center. The center opened in 2020. It still features coal hoppers, a control panel, and industrial piping. Beloit College even saved the plant's smokestack, though it no longer produces billowing clouds. Dan Schuf is with the college. He says there's something symbolic about the project.
It was polluting for a purpose to generate power, but it did a lot of damage in the community, as all coal plants did. And so for us now to take that and be a place of learning, that's a different kind of energy.
Despite the closure of coal plants, environmental groups are critical of some utilities' plans to replace them with natural gas plants. They say more work is needed to get to zero carbon emissions. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Turn on the faucet, take a swig. How does it taste? Columbus, Wisconsin is making a splash as winner of this year's Great American Water Taste Test. Jake Tanner is lead water operator for Columbus Water Utilities. That's a community near Madison. Colin, with a question, you can share comments about the taste of water, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jake, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi there, how are you?
I'm doing well. So your city wins this gold in this year's taste test by the National Rural Water Association. What's your reaction to the win?
It was a big win for the utility and for the citizens of Columbus. Definitely was not expecting it. But after winning the Wisconsin Award last year in 2023, we moved on to the national awards, and it's definitely a big honor.
Okay, so you were moving on from a Wisconsin Award to a national field. Who was in this field? Who are you competing against?
So we compete against multiple different utilities in the state of Wisconsin. So I think last year there was right around 25 different cities that entered in last year for the Wisconsin one. So we won that, and then we sent it to Washington, D.C. this past February for the nationals, and that's competing against all of the winners from each 50 state. So it's thousands of different water samples that we had to beat out. Well, that every state had to beat, and then we beat all 50 states.
Why do you think you had it in you? Why enter the competition?
I think for the city of Columbus, we remove all of our iron in our water through an iron filter, and we also soften our water. And through the last couple of years of being the lead water operator here, I've tweaked our chemical addition and got it basically to the level that it needs to be. And we're not over chemical usage or addition, and where you don't smell it or taste it anymore, where that's a lot of problem in a lot of cities where you can, the balance of the chemicals is not right.
What makes your water taste good?
The removal of the iron, the softening, and then also we have our wells drilled right around 675 feet below ground, and we have a lot of limestone in our area, which is good for filtration.
Okay, so other than improving taste, what else are you adding or trying to remove while treating water?
So we remove the iron, of course, and then other metals that are in the water through our iron filter, and then we soften our water, which basically is a better tasting water and easier to like rinse your body off with shampoo and things like that.
Does that mean that your residents don't need to have water softeners in their homes?
Yeah, that's correct. So we completed a water meter changeout program, and we're in every single house. And I'd say maybe 5 to 7% of our customers have softeners in their house. So it's definitely a great benefit for our customers softening our water.
So many communities around our state are grappling with toxic forever chemicals with PFAS. The State Department of Natural Resources has that map with over 60 sites that are contaminated. What is your utility doing to protect the water from PFAS?
So we obviously have a big containment and make sure there's nothing spilled around our wells. And then also we have to do testing every year for PFAS and all those chemicals, those forever chemicals. And we passed with no detection for the Wisconsin DNR one earlier this year. And then we also were selected for the EPA sampling, small community sampling across the United States, and we had a no detect there as well.
You know, certainly for this water tasting test, I mean, with PFAS, you can't smell, you can't taste, you can't, you know, these toxic forever chemicals, you know, you can't really detect them in the water that if you're drinking it. So you probably, for this judging, the judges weren't considering PFAS.
Nope. It was all about clarity, taste, and odor.
Isn't taste, though, highly subjective? I mean, is this, does one palate differ from the next?
Yeah, I would assume so. And I had the opportunity last week, actually, to be the guest judge for the Wisconsin water taste test again this year. And it's definitely a wide range of taste buds from each judge. But what I can say from the Wisconsin one is that it's 5 judges that are there, and they have a maximum of 30 points per sample that they're tasting. And then whoever wins with the most points is the winner.
So how do you cleanse your palate between samples?
We didn't do much, but I can definitely tell you there's a large difference in tasting water throughout the state of Wisconsin.
Jake Tanner is lead water operator for Columbus Water Utilities, award-winning water taste. And you can call in with a question or share your comments along the way at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dozens of communities nationwide, they vie for the distinction of having the best tasting water. Columbus, a city in south-central Wisconsin, earns the top spot in the 25th annual contest put on by the National Rural Water Association. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts about the taste of tap water. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jake Tanner is here, lead water operator for Columbus Water Utilities. Jake, the state requires cities to use certain chemicals in their water treatment, like chlorine, an oxidizing agent. The DNR says the chemicals can filter out iron and lime and soda ash. How much latitude do you have? How much can utilities customize their water supply within state regulations?
So we have to add it, but there's set parameters on different chemicals that we do add for the levels that we have to maintain within our system. So like each chemical is different, and you just can play with that range that they give you and try and find out which range is the best for your water, because each water is different for chemical addition.
You said you have done some tweaking there. Do you find that you have enough ability to affect taste and do what you really need to do to your water?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a long waiting game, because obviously there's nothing immediate in the change. You got to basically flush out your whole system, get everything flushed out. So tweaking the chemicals, tweaking chlorine, just so you don't smell it when you turn your faucet on, is such a big thing. And it's a big deterrent for customers when you open up your faucet and you smell chlorine. So I think we're at that point now where there's not much chlorine smell, but we're still effectively adding it and killing any bacteria that potentially could be in the system.
What about residents who are skeptical? Consumer Reports last year said Americans drink roughly 15 billion gallons of bottled water a year. What can municipalities do to get people drinking more tap water?
I think it's just the education part on bottled water. If you drive behind a grocery store or something, you just see pallets of bottled water sitting out in the direct sunlight. All that plastic is leaching right into your water, and there's not many regulations on bottled water. So when we have a lot more restrictions for utilities and city water, and we're closely monitored by the DNR, the EPA, I think it's much safer and a better water for yourself to drinking from the city.
Do you find that in your city there is significant trust in its tap water system?
I believe so, yeah. There's a lot of customers that enjoy our water, and obviously there's always negatives by certain people, but there's definitely a lot more positives.
What advice do you have for other municipalities who are hoping to improve the taste of their water?
I think the biggest is, like I said earlier, tweaking your chemicals and just getting that right range for your addition, so you're still effectively treating your water, but also having where you're not smelling or tasting it is such a big thing. And even like the iron filters that we have, they're such a vital thing to our water that filters out any iron and metals. That iron is a very smelly like element, so once you have no iron in your water, it's almost virtually like there's no odor to it.
I wonder, do the private wells in your area have similar good-tasting water?
I believe so. So the village of Fall River, which is just next to us, they've also won the Wisconsin taste test multiple years ago. So it's definitely something in this area that has some good water with all the limestone that we are sitting on top of.
So for the competition, how much sample water did you need to provide? Where did you draw it from? How does that work with your entry?
So for the Wisconsin one, all we need is a pint glass of water. We take it right from our break room kitchen faucet. So it's right in our system. They require it somewhere in your system. So we take it from our break room. And then the one that we sent out to Washington, D.C. was 2 half-gallon jugs of water. So we had to ship that out, package it up nicely, and make sure it got out to Washington, D.C.
How did you, what did you put it in? I would imagine not plastic.
Nope. So actually for the National Rural Water taste test, they send us these very nice glass bottles that are engraved with Columbus Utilities, and each utility that is sending a sample in gets these, and then it's like pre-packaged. So then you just take the big glass bottles out and put it back in once you have it filled up, and it's all covered in foam and plastic so nothing can break.
I imagine that glass bottle fills you with pride for your water.
Yeah, absolutely. Just being able to do this for our community, and it's such a great honor.
We're talking about tap water, drinking water. Jake Tanner with us, lead water operator for Columbus Water Utilities, a national award for good tasting water. Call in with a question along the way. Share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Jake, last year, the product testing company NSF found more than 90% of Americans use filters at home for their drinking water. How necessary are these at-home filters for tap water?
It really depends on each community and the water quality in that area. The biggest thing with filters is people don't realize you have to change out the filter. And once you break that, the lifespan of that filter, and if you don't change it out, you're actually going to be drinking a lot higher concentration of those chemicals or elements that are in the water, because you're basically taking all those extra chemicals that you removed in the filter, and you're going to actually put it back into the water once your filter life has passed.
Oh, so you're running them through a dirty filter. That doesn't help in any way.
Exactly. So if you change it out regularly, then it's a great thing for people.
Is there any tips that you have for people who would like to improve the taste of their tap water, make it taste more like Columbus?
I think it's depends on where you live, and if you can get one of those inline filters after your water meter in your basement, and those are always nice, but obviously reverse osmosis, you can use that as well, but that's a pretty costly addition to your house.
For a water operator, is it easy to figure out what is causing poor taste in water?
No. Yes and no, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of, you can obviously find out the smells. Each chemical has a smell, and like elements in your water has smells. So you can figure that stuff out. But the taste, you can tweak things and things like that, but a lot of it comes from how you're pulling it out of the ground and what your water is being filtered through.
Christine in Milwaukee is here. Christine, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. You were kind of touching on the question I had a bit, but sometimes, you know, it's obviously concerns. I think the consumer concern is not just with the water itself, but the, you know, the what the water travels through. Issues like with Flint, Michigan, that have been so tragic, and as well as with, you know, or just lead in the pipes or other issues that have come up over time. And
Christine, I have to jump in here because we're short on time. Can you respond there, Jake, to running tap water and running water through pipes?
It's the age of pipes, and also if you're worried, you can always install those filters and keep your water cleaner for yourself.
Okay, and so with lead pipes, you know, it is really about that filtration system.
That's correct.
Yeah, yeah. Well, congratulations, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jake Tanner is lead water operator for Columbus Water Utilities, recently won a national award for great tasting water, beating out dozens of other communities. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Maritime shipping season is underway at the Twin Ports. We learn about safety measures in the Duluth Superior Harbor and what it's like to navigate ocean vessels. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is producer Tyler Ditter with a story about growing up on a farm.
Life on the farm used to be a common experience for many in this state. But with the number of family farms dwindling in Wisconsin, fewer people grow up ingrained in the hardworking family tradition that has bonded communities for generations. Eileen Bartolow talked about life on the farm in Wayside with her daughter Rachel as part of a StoryCorps mobile tour stop in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
The farm has been in the family since 1863. My grandpa, when he was running the farm, he was injured in a barn raising at one point. When they were putting up the sides of the barn, you know, they'd build it and then put up the sides and people would help with that. So at the age of 14, my dad kind of was taking over the farm and doing the majority of the farm work.
So then your dad took over when he was 14. So the years that he was in charge of the farm, was he working there until his death in the 90s or?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Okay. 100%. He also, you know, had some hired help. And then raising six boys, he had some built-in help.
Yeah.
And then also he was involved in community things too, you know, involved in either farm committees. He was a bank director. He was active in the telephone company. So sometimes he really needed the hired hands. But in my growing up, he was primarily just working on the farm. And Dan and I did a lot of the farm work with them because by then all the other brothers were gone and away from home.
So the years you were actually on the farm living there was when you were born, 1953.
Till I went to college. I came back a couple summers and worked on the farm also then, but really pretty much till I got married.
Do you have any specific memories that stick out from growing up on the farm?
Oh yeah, we had to get up for chores every morning.
What time?
Be out there at 6 o'clock for milking. That was always when we started.
Do you have a rooster that woke you up?
My mom. And I remember a number of times when she had to come back from the barn and arouse us again. So apparently it wasn't effective the first time.
That continued on into the next generation. I remember that. Did you take turns? Like, was it 7 days a week you're out there, or did you get a couple days off while the
aunt
took over?
It was 7 days a week. I remember being out there, you know, before school, and then we'd come in and get ready for school, and we didn't take a lot of time for that, you know, a quick breakfast and get ready. I remember wearing a scarf over my head always so that my hair wouldn't have a lot of barn smell, you know, when I was going to school and stuff. You know, you think about that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure a classroom of farm kids could get a little
smelled
bit
a little
smelly.
Different than others.
Yeah, so that, you know, certainly was the work ethic that you learn, the responsibility.
So the farm, as you knew it, and what you grew up with, burned basically to the ground in 2001. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, it was very devastating to see all that. On the other hand, it was also very heartwarming because that very day, you know, the neighbors all came over and with trailers and trucks because the cows had to get out of there and they had to do some fast work to figure out where all those cows were going to go because they had to be milked that night. You know, you could just see the beauty of the farm community and that it's still going even though so much time has passed. You know, to see that, oh yeah, that still is carried on through the next generations when the need is there.
Yeah.
Those core values are there, and that caring for community and caring for each other, which was pretty overwhelming to see.
That was Eileen and Rachel Bordalo. Their interviews were recorded at StoryCorps, a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of WPR and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Great Lakes maritime shipping season is underway with the docking of the Barbro G, the ocean-going vessels about the length of two football fields, here gliding under Duluth's aerial lift bridge on Monday. As we discuss port safety and infrastructure in light of the Baltimore bridge collapse, call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Deb DeLuca is Executive Director of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. Deb, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you, and good morning, Anne. And it's always I'm always happy to be on Wisconsin Public Radio, my home state public radio.
Thank you for that. How did you react to the Baltimore Bridge collapse tragedy?
Well, of course, it was a horrible human tragedy with the loss of life occurring from the workers on the bridge. And anything like that affects that involves shipping, of course, is very sobering. But the damage was shocking to see how quickly that bridge went down.
In a matter of seconds, and watching that video, I'm sure you had a lot of emotions. What was coming up for you?
Well, of course, it makes us reflect on our own harbor and the safety measures that we have in place. I thought that the dispatch activity, the fact that the vessel, clearly the pilot and the captain of the vessel, they were doing what they could. They were trying to problem solve in real, or they were problem solving in real time. And the fact that they put out the dispatch call and they closed the bridge in a very short span of time, saved lives. That there were cars that got off the bridge and were not allowed onto the bridge in that amount of time. So if you look at in terms of our harbor, the bridge configuration is very different, and we do have we do have safety measures in place. So I'll let you ask the questions, though, because my head went to all of that because I knew the questions would be coming.
Yeah. Well, my mind goes to the aerial lift bridge. I was just there a few days ago on that bridge and thinking about Baltimore. Is the bridge vulnerable to collapsing if struck by a cargo ship?
Well, think about the case of the Francis Scott Key Bridge, that those piers are in the water, in the navigation channel. Mm-hmm. And just to be clear, that condition exists around the world and around our nation. That's not an unusual configuration for a bridge pier to be in the water. But this is a very, very, very rare occurrence. So please keep that in mind. First of all, in regards to the lift bridge, there is no pier in the water, right? The bridge spans, the support for the bridge are in the, in the ground, in the land side, on either side of that relatively narrow channel, unlike the Key Bridge that had, I think the spans were almost a mile long. So it's a short span bridge, very, robust infrastructure on either side. And so an elision would not, with the cement, along the edges of the ship canal, would not be very unlikely to take out that bridge. You know, it wouldn't affect the bridge supports.
Yeah. You mentioned the communication and the dispatch. The cargo ship in Baltimore reportedly lost power before the collision. How are ship operators trained to respond in emergencies like that?
Well, what you saw happen in Baltimore is how they're trained to respond. You know, there is constant contact between the vessel operators and people on shore, right? Whether it's when they're coming into their berth or so that capability for dispatch is available around the country, or I should say prepared for around the country.
Also, what struck me was the just the fast ability for personnel and equipment to arrive at the scene, tugboats and barges and cranes all working, just so soon after the disaster. What is that capacity like at Twin Ports if disaster strikes? How quickly can you mobilize?
Well, first of all, I'm not an expert about what happened in Baltimore, but you know that's a huge credit to them, and that involved response at the federal and state level. You saw that Secretary Buttigieg was Department of Transportation Secretary Buttigieg was there and present, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, promising support. That, and I want to also give a lot of credit to the Coast Guard, who is in charge of safety protocols for harbors. Right, that's there throughout the U.S. So that same kind of response would be available here. I have to say, there's a safety plan for the harbor that the U.S. Coast Guard maintains, and that we have an area safety group. I'm not using the Coast Guard's world is full of acronyms, so I'm not using the correct name.
That's okay.
But for the area safety committee. That plans ahead for threats and dangers in the harbor, and so those protocols are in place.
And do you review the harbor's emergency plan regularly?
It is reviewed regularly by the Coast Guard and the emergency response. The emergency responders that are part of that group.
I wonder if you could help provide some contrast between a container ship like the Dolly, loaded with, thousands of containers of different goods, versus navigational challenges of a typical barge carrying ore pellets in the Duluth Superior Harbor.
Well, I want to be really fair. I saw comments, I'm sure you followed the news, and every day there's another take on what's happened, and statements from ports that like ours care deeply about what happened. But our vessels can be loaded out at 70,000 tons of iron ore. That's a heavy boat. Mm-hmm. The boats are not as wide. Our ships are not as wide as the container ship that you saw in the Baltimore case, but they are nearly as long, and they can be weighted very heavily. All of our vessels, I should add that our international vessels always have its requirement that they have a pilot on board that knows the system, and those pilots are shifted out as they cross from the entrance to the St. Lawrence Seaway to all the way into Duluth. So there's always a pilot on board, and that pilot is switched out along the transit, and they know the local configurations and waterways that they need to transit. So that provides a level of safety. I will say that in the Baltimore case, there were two pilots on board, and that's a very different harbor and a different
configuration,
pilot requirement.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, the captains for the domestic vessels are essentially trained at pilot. They are at pilot level. In fact, they become pilots when they retire, because they know the system and the waterway so well. So and then when those vessels enter the harbor, the speed limit, so to say, is 8 knots, which is about 9 miles an hour. And those vessels travel even slower than that to navigate turns and tighter spaces and the like.
Deb DeLuca with us, oversees Duluth Seaway Port Authority at the westernmost tip of Lake Superior, as we discuss the opening of the maritime shipping season and port safety in light of the Baltimore tragedy. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the safety of ocean-going ships after the deadly bridge collapse in Baltimore. The annual shipping season is underway at the Duluth Superior Harbor, with the Barbara G gliding into the harbor Monday to pick up Midwestern wheat that's destined for Algeria. Deb DeLuca is here, Executive Director of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. You can call in with a question, add thoughts, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jeff in Superior. Jeff, hello.
Well, good morning. Thank you for this opportunity, this discussion. I'm excited to tell you a couple things. When I was in high school, I went to the Port Authority office with my Russian language class. And we met with a Russian ship that was also loading loading wheat that year. And I'll never forget that. That was really exciting to see how the port, operates on a daily basis. I had a couple thoughts about the Baltimore disaster. You know, at the footings where the pilings go into the water, I thought they could have created like a cone shape where the ship would run aground before it would hit the footing. You know, that would be a safety protection that might run out, you know, 100 feet or so around the footing. It would be underwater, so you wouldn't actually see it, but I mean, it would protect the integrity of the bridge, you know, by protecting the footing, and it wouldn't collapse.
Kind of like a guardrail, yeah.
Or something underwater, like a bunch of rock or sand, where the ship would run aground before it hit the piling. My other thought is, do you have any updates on the Blatnik Bridge project? Have you had to work with Wisconsin Department of Transportation on how that's going to traverse the bay?
Jeff, thanks so much for those thoughts and that story at the outset. Deb, what comes up?
I'll answer that question, but Jeff, I love your story about your high school class, and I will say we just welcomed the Barbara G this week and had our first ship ceremony, and as part of that first ship ceremony, we go on board and we're up on the bridge with a captain, and that captain, Smirnov, was from the Ukraine, and just a very delightful conversation ensued, and very interesting individual. So that's fun to hear about your class. But sorry, your question is about the Blatnik Bridge and how the Wisconsin Department of Transportation and Minnesota Department of Transportation work collaboratively on both the design and the funding of that bridge. And you've seen they've been very successful on the funding aspect. I'll say from the outset, whether it's the design of that bridge or the Twin Ports Interchange in the case of landside transportation that affects the port, the Minnesota Department of Transportation and Wisconsin Department of Transportation come to the Port Authority right away to discuss, you know, what are height needs, what are turning radius needs, all this, you know, that's turning radius is more for the road, but they are very attuned to the needs of the marine shipping and incorporate that into the design for the vessel. They are. They're very far along on the design for the Blatnik, and they've taken, you know, they're using the most modern methods. And anyway, point is that they've taken this into consideration. And I've heard, but I haven't had a chance to check in with them, that they are also kind of tinkering with the design a little bit in regards to the threat of elision.
But you feel that you're very much looped into the process for the Blatnik.
Yes, and their design expertise is supreme. I mean, they're really very good at what they do.
You mentioned the Barbara OG, and, you know, with the port and this week the harbor welcoming the first ocean-going vessel for the season, what does port traffic mean for the local economy?
Well, where do I start? Mm-hmm. Shipping is really sort of the economic backbone of this of the Twin Ports region. That's really why, you know, the fact that we are a nexus point for maritime, road, rail transportation is what really brought, you know, what made us grow into the size that we are. And, you know, it represents around 8,000 jobs locally per the tonnage that moves across the through the port every year. It represents about 8,000 jobs regionally, I should say. Has about a $1.4 billion economic impact. And I think my head is working off our older numbers. That number should be elevated based on last year's economic impact.
Sure,
study.
Sure. With iron ore shipping, you've seen an increase there in tonnage. What's driving the growth of iron ore?
Well, there's high demand for, you know, high steel demand in the U.S., and that's driven by many factors. There's been a lot of construction, but in addition to that, all the IRA and IJA money that the Biden administration has put out that supports transportation infrastructure and clean energy transition, that's also driving more construction. So anyway, high steel demand, and that's always good for iron ore tonnage. Anything that drives up iron ore tonnage is, of course, good for the Port of Duluth Superior. And on top of that, I will say that the mines are at full production, and that, you know, the plants are at full production. That also helps. You should see the stacks of iron ore at the ore docks right now are, you know, all ready to open the season and to go out to the steelmaking facilities on the lower Great Lakes.
They're all poised there and ready to go. In our last few moments together, what do you anticipate for the upcoming cruise ship season?
Ooh, cruise ship is, I think it's going to be pretty much like last year. It's a continuation. You know, Viking, of course, is back. And then we have additional cruise vessel lines coming as well. So we're excited to look ahead one more year. The dock wall at the Duluth Entertainment and Convention Center, where the ship's dock will be completed for the next vessel season. And we're looking forward to that. And we're looking forward to the shipping season. I want to say it looks like a very promising, promising for iron ore. Iron ore had a very strong year last year. We're expecting that to continue. Grain had a nice uptick at the end of last year, and of course we are excited about the new liner service that we developed that started last year between Antwerp and Duluth.
And lots going on. Yes, Deb, thank you for checking in. Thanks for joining us. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Kate. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Deb DeLuca, Executive Director of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. He's called America's greatest storyteller. More than 100 million copies of books sold, setting a record as the first author to do it, according to Publishers Weekly. And now, after penning hundreds of crime novels and thrillers, James Patterson pays tribute to the talented booksellers and librarians in his latest read. And you can be part of this salute to people who work in the stacks. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. James Patterson's book is called The Secret Lives of Booksellers and Librarians, True Stories of the Magic of Reading. James, what an honor. Welcome to the Ideas Network.
I'm honored. This is great. And I love doing this. I love putting the book together. You know, I started this kind of series of nonfiction. A friend of mine, Matt Eversman. Matt was the actual sergeant who was portrayed in the movie Black Hawk Down. And he's really great at interviews, at getting people to talk. And our mission, we did one on ER nurses, and we're doing one on teachers now. But our mission with this was that if you are a librarian or you are a bookseller, you'd say Eversman and Patterson got it exactly right. And how could we not? Because it's all based on interviews that we cut down into these 5 or 6 page chapters. So that and the other part of it is, if you thought you understood what librarians and booksellers do, you're in for a big surprise, because it's not what you think it is, which is, I think that's a real fun part of the book.
And it's these really cool vignettes, little glimpses, little stories that you peek into the lives of booksellers and librarians. How did you choose who to feature in this book?
The publisher helped a lot in terms of Little Brown reaching out to people who they thought would be pretty good interviews. So we started there, and then I don't know, we did 100 and a quarter, something like that, interviews. And then, as I say, you take these, the interviews themselves would not have been a good book. But taking those down and then cutting them into these 5 or 6 pages, where you get a sense for that human being, that person, that bookseller, that librarian. And that's where the secret lives comes from, which is, there's a little bit of a wink in that, which is kind of fun. And I thought, and they do, librarians, and they like the title because it's fun. And a lot of these people, they are fun. I mean, I do a lot of speaking engagements, and some of the best are big groups of either librarians or booksellers, because they get my jokes, they get the literary references. It's very cool. Very nice.
It's all in the family. You've really tried to boost independent booksellers, We hear bits and pieces of that effort in this, from the mouths of booksellers in Utah and in California. Why support indie booksellers?
Why not? why would I not? I mean, the bigger question is, why wouldn't you? Of course I would. I'll tell you what, my mother and grandmother get all the kudos here, because their thing was go out and help. My grandmother was big on, she had a very small restaurant, and she would give away a lot of free food over the weekend to people that needed free food. My mother was a teacher, taught in a Catholic school, so she made nothing. They paid her in change. It wasn't even big enough to have dollar bills. But she also was a librarian on the weekend. So my three sisters and I, we grew up on leftovers and every weekend we were in the library. But they're the ones that got me interested in this and interested in giving back. And I don't go into this that much, but my family, we've given over $150 million now. And everything that we have, ultimately, half of it will go to literacy and teachers. We have a big thing, actually, at University of Wisconsin. We have a lot of scholarships there. And we have a program which I love. It was Wisconsin's idea. And what it is, it's for people who are going to be teachers. And the deal is that if you go to Wisconsin, if you teach in Wisconsin, that first year, we will forgive 1/3 of your student debt. Second year, another third. Third year, another. So if you teach in Wisconsin for 3 years, your student debt is gone. Hmm. And that's great for the kids. It's great for the University of Wisconsin. And it's great for the state, because the state is benefiting from that. And I love that kind of very pragmatic, close the circle kind of thing, where everybody is benefiting from it. So we love that. But that's what we do. And that's a lot of what this, I will not earn one penny off of this book. Everything will go back. Nothing. I won't earn anything. So who cares? But that's kind of my deal.
Talking with author James Patterson, newest book, The Secret Lives of Booksellers and Librarians. You can call in questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. James, several booksellers talk about the relationships they have with authors, and you know this firsthand, I'm sure. I mean, one Florida bookseller talks about how author Brad Meltzer always makes special trips to her bookstore, how they got to know each other's families. How does that relationship, work between author and bookseller?
Well, it's really all over the lot. And some booksellers, Chris Grabenstein, who I've done a bunch of kids' books with, he must go to about 50 a year. I don't do that as much. I did a lot more in the beginning. And, you know, and I actually remember the first one I ever did. It was way back, and it was at in the World Trade Center, which is weird. There was a orders, I think, in the basement there. And they had about 100 books sitting in there, and nobody came. It was just my girlfriend at the time. And she just sat across the table from me when we pretended that I was signing her book and stuff. So it wouldn't be too, I mean, yeah, that was the reality. That was the first one. Memorable. Never forgot that one. I remember going, this was an official signing, but I went to one store and it was a drop-in signing. They knew I was coming. And they're like, oh my God, James, this is so cool. And we're slapping fives and slapping high fives going back through the store. And they go, we got hundreds of your books in the back to sign. And I go back to the back of the store and they have them laid out in tables, Richard North Patterson books. So I signed them.
Yeah. Hey, anyway. You know, you do what you have to do. You know, well, there is a famous author, Judy Blume, I want to bring up, featured bookseller.
Judy's in the book. Yeah.
Yeah. And talks about how that, you know, that you know, becoming a bookseller in Key West. What did you learn from Judy's story? What did you take away from it?
One, just the honor of having her in the book, which is great. You know, part of it is at a certain point, she really didn't want to write too much or write at all. And she needed a kind of a second life. And she kind of decided she wanted to start the store. And she says she goes to the store pretty much every day and she loves it. She loves going there. She loves, you know, meeting the people that come in. She loves working with the staff. And she's not a fool about it. I mean, she's very pragmatic. She'll tell the staff, we have to sell books. If we don't sell books, we can't stay open. If we don't sell books, you can't get paid, you know, which is good. I mean, it's a good thing to have both the high-minded thing of, you know, hand selling and we're going to make the world a better place. But also, you know, we need to survive, which is a very real problem. And everybody in bookstores, you know, needs to understand that, and some do and some don't.
She brings up, it's really interesting, and I'd never really thought about it, but how booksellers sometimes have to return books that don't sell. You know, as a writer, you never want to return anybody's book. So sure. She feels that to her heart. I mean, what don't we understand about book inventory?
I would have no problem with that. That's fine. You know, you open the door to them, you do your best, but you have to have a business. You have to send them back. It's like, you know, if you have a gallery, and, you know, somebody's paintings aren't selling. Well, it's not like you didn't want them to sell. You want them to sell, but they just aren't. People are coming in, and so you have to, you know, have to go in with new artists. It's just the way life works, unfortunately.
Part of the business. We have prolific author James Patterson with us, sharing his gratitude for the people who match all kinds of readers with books that they'll devour. His latest read is called The Secret Lives of Booksellers and Librarians. You can be part of this conversation. Call in with a question, add your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with best-selling author James Patterson is here. His thrillers sell millions of copies a year. Latest book could be considered a passion project. It shines a light on booksellers and librarians who Patterson describes work long hours to keep reading alive and get little recognition in return. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share thoughts. 800-642-1234. Patterson's book is called The Secret Lives of Booksellers and Librarians. And we have Chelsea in Hartford, who is a librarian. Chelsea, hi.
Hi. First of all, just want to say, huge fan of James Patterson. I'm so into your nonfiction books, and I'm really excited to read this new one. But as an outreach librarian, I am spending hours of my day driving around our community in Hartford and delivering books to the senior community. And every week, I check out at least 20 of James Patterson's books, the series. I have an individual who's read all of your series, and he's now working on your nonfiction books right now. And I'm so just super excited to have you in this morning on NPR.
Oh.
Really enjoyable as I'm sitting in the parking lot at work.
Okay, all right. How's the weather up there? Yeah. A little cool? You're going to get snow, I think,
so
soon,
gross.
Right? Yeah. Oh, well, okay. Sorry about
so
that.
Gross.
Yeah.
What comes up for you, James, for an outreach librarian taking books all around a community?
There's just so many different groups that need help, and obviously senior citizens, and especially stay-ins. That's one of them. Kids, obviously, another one. Prisons. We have a couple of librarians in the book who deal with prisoners, and I've gone two or three times to prisons to talk to inmates, and one of the sort of sad things about it is especially a lot of young males and or young females, and they didn't read much in school, or they weren't good readers, or and now they read a lot. And if they had done that in grade school and high school, a lot of them wouldn't be there, because mm-hmm. they would have had more opportunities and more choices and more chances. And that's a huge thing. I have I work with the University of Florida. This is their program, not mine. And the percentage of kids reading at grade level in the country is 43%, which is hideous. But they have a program that can get it up into the 80s, which we're actually, we have it at about 20% of Florida now. Florida actually in the reading area is pretty good. They're up around 50%, which is one of the higher states. And they're number one in terms of highest percentage of Black kids who can read at grade level, and also Latino or Latinx, depending on what your preference is there. But there are just so many groups that need help. And getting kids reading in particular is great. And getting people at home, who can't get out or have trouble getting out is also a big deal. And as I get older, I'm much more sympathetic to that group.
Yes. I want to turn our attention to book challenges. And we see that popping up in the stories that come from your librarians and booksellers.
Uh-huh.
And there's this particular former public librarian in Texas talks about this conflict with her boss and the city government about book censorship, and Suzette Baker refusing to take books off the shelves that people complained were inappropriate for kids. What is your reaction to a story like that?
I tell you, I don't like preaching to the converted. And unfortunately, the way we're talking, most of the people who are going to be listening are going to be the converted. I'm really most interested in talking to people who think book banning is okay. And to that group, talking their language, especially people that theoretically don't want the government in their face on things, I always say, I don't want strangers telling my family members what they should and shouldn't read, which should appeal to people, even people who theoretically are going, book banning is okay. They should go, yeah, right. Or, you take care of your house, I'll take care of my house. Once again, just trying to talk to people who are at least on the fence about this thing.
Hmm.
It's a silly thing that's going on. It isn't as dangerous as you make it out to be, but it could be. It could be horrifying. I've had books banned now. Maximum Ride has been banned in a few counties, which is crazy. There's nothing in Maximum Ride. I think 30 million kids have read it, and they're okay. They're doing all right. But there's no reason to be. I mean, every once in a while, there probably is a book. Somebody writes a book, How to Be a Nazi at 10 Years Old. Yeah, we probably should ban that. But it should be so rare that a book gets banned. It should almost never happen. And maybe people think that book should be in the library, too. I'd kind of go along with banning that particular one. One of your
librarian depicts these book challenges coming from a small, noisy, well-organized group of people.
Yes.
Do you find that description kind of accurate to what you're seeing?
It certainly is a big piece of the puzzle. I know in the case of my books, at least in two of the counties, one woman came in. She complained about Maximum Ride. She said it shouldn't be that middle schooler shouldn't be reading it. She had never read it. And, you know, the other piece of it is, you know, they talk about, well, the parents have the right. I think the parents do have the right when a kid brings home a book to talk. You know, if an 8-year-old brings home Hunger Games, I think it's fine for you to say, honey, I'm not sure if you're ready for that. Let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. And I would love parents, all parents, to be that involved with their kids and what they're reading, and more important, what they're doing on the internet or on their phones. Parent involvement, great. Parents dictating what other parents should do, not great.
Rachel sent along an email, says they're a big fan of you. They first read the Maximum Ride series in school, was interested in owning a bookshop at one point in their youth, but gave up that dream as they saw the decline in physical media. Rachel's heard that books and physical media are slowly making a comeback. Do you think that we will see more bookstores opening in the future? And Rachel's wondering, is it a financially smart move to get into this industry?
No, but it's a one. Look, there's a quote. I don't know where it came from, but I've been living by it for the last year and a half or so. And it's sort of what I am. The projects I'm going to take on or not take on. Like, I just finished completing a book that Michael Crichton had started, and his widow came to me. He's been dead for 12, 13 years now. And his widow came and she said, Michael had started this book and then he died somewhat unexpectedly. Would you like to finish it? And I said, well, I don't know. Let me read it. Let me read what he wrote. And I read what he wrote, and I thought it was really fascinating. And I said to her, yes, I'd like to finish it because I want to know how the hell it turns out, you know. But the quote, which I think is relevant here, is my time here is limited. And I think it's as true for me as it is for 20-year-olds. It may be more important for 20-year-olds. My time here is limited. What can I do most beautifully? You know, and that really is that brings clarity, and you think about it. You know, so in terms of starting a bookstore, I think in general books are doing better now than they did 5-6 years ago. Bookstores are a little better shaped than they were, not all, but some. Books are, I think, doing, you know, semi reasonably right now. But in terms of starting a bookstore, that's a tough one, and that gets down to what can I do most beautifully. And if that's what you think it is, then it's worth considering, not as a financial thing. Although some, you know, look, if you really figure it out and you work hard and you can, you know, but it's very difficult. One of the tricks is if you can get, and it's hard work, if you can get a bunch of authors in there a couple a week, especially well-known authors, you can make it and probably do pretty well.
It was so interesting. Yeah, these stories shows just like the hard work that booksellers have, that it's not sitting around and getting in reading time when you're running a business like this.
Now, one of the booksellers, which I love the line, she said when she interviews people, you know, a lot of people think you're just going to sit around the store and read books. That's not really true. You work, you have to stack those things. And her line to people that she's interviewing was, do you like to clean toilets? and because that's the reality of it in the store is you're busy. That the hand selling part is great. And that's that in almost all cases, that drives both the booksellers and the librarians. They love that idea of turning people on to books that they hadn't discovered. And the joy when people come back and go, I love that book that you recommended. That was great.
That's the people
part.
But it
is part. An incredible amount of hard work. That's the
But then there's the inventory part and all of those other tasks.
Exactly.
Yeah. We're with bestselling author James Patterson, written hundreds of books spanning genres. His latest one is called The Secret Lives of Booksellers and Librarians. Call in with a question. You can share stories about the people who lead you to great books. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with prolific wordsmith and bestselling author James Patterson is here. Pays tribute to the people who sell and lend books. He calls their work crucial for our country and that no profession is more noble. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. James Patterson's book is called The Secret Lives of Booksellers and Librarians. James, we heard from Jean called from Eau Claire with a comment, says their hospital library purchases new books, and so they read your Walk in My Combat Boots. And Jean said it was a great book as their son had joined the Marines 2 years ago, left for training in California, and the book gave Jean a different look on military life. What do you, there's a hospital library purchase there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, no, look, there's so many places. We need common sense. We need people to, I give you one, if you go in New York or London or Paris, and a lot of the really great museums there have these big banners over the front door, big, exciting looking banners. And if not every library, but if libraries would put a huge banner over the front door, the free state, really cool looking banners, the free store, that's a real come on in kind of thing, which they need to do. If there was a free store in your local mall, the line would be around the block. Everything in here is free. Well, that's what libraries are. Everything in there is free. You got books, you got music, you've got video, you have, well, and it's all free. It's the greatest thing in the world. It's not a place for like, that kind of shush thing, you know, it's a free store. But I think part of it is with stores and whatever, you just go, yeah, this is what we have to do. And it is a noble thing to do, but it's more noble if people use the library. It's more noble if people use the bookstore. So they should consider being a little bit more aggressive in terms of reaching out to people. One of the cool things, it was a library, I'm not sure where she was, but I love the notion of that libraries and bookstores shouldn't be political. Mm-hmm. You can get books on vegetarianism. You can get books on hunting. You can get books on every religion. You can get books on every different way of looking at the world. And it all works in there all together. Yeah. and in peace.
One of my favorite intersections there was that a bookseller is somewhere between a bartender, a priest, and a therapist. I loved that melding and what that relationship is like. There was also a bookseller who talks about the importance of remaining non-judgmental about people's reading choices.
Yes. 100%.
Yeah. Yes. You know, are there books that should be read or should we just not care about what people pick up?
I think we should care, and you can help a little bit if you see that somebody has an interest in whatever it is, and they're not necessarily going toward the better examples of that. I think it's fine to you love baseball, whatever the heck it is, consider this one because this one is a really, really good baseball book, or whatever your interest is. And I think that's a great thing. Or trying to get people to stretch, you know, with our son Jack. Our thing was always with Jack is we just kept opening doors and here's a door. Oh, look what's in here. You know, not saying you should or you shouldn't or whatever. and that worked reasonably well with him.
Just, you know? Those suggestions.
A little bit. If you see somebody's interest or, you know, and if you find that somebody's particularly open, then, you know, what about this kind of thing? Yeah. You know? And a lot of times with people, you don't really know what you're going to like until you try something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I said, the trick with this book is going to be getting people to understand that this is a really fun read. Because they go, well, I don't know if I want to read a book about librarians. I don't know well, it's going to be interesting. If you have an interest in libraries and bookstores, and certainly most people listening probably do. And you know, here's stories that you haven't heard before, and you're going to understand these people in a way that you never had before. And I always love, anytime I read a book or read a movie where I really come to a new understanding, especially if I think I understand and I don't. I mean, that's the thing about when I did with Matt Erisman, that Walk in My Combat Boots, a lot of people think they understand the military, but they don't.
Hmm.
And they read the book, and it's not that it's not pro-military or it's just military. Here it is. Here's what it's all about. And it's good for people to understand. It's just understanding is a great thing. We need more of it. Well, we need more of people sort of stepping outside of whatever, you know, they set up this iron box that they live in. Step outside it, man, please.
Well, speaking of suggestions and the younger generation, book talk comes up in this, a sector of the social media app TikTok where people talk about the books they enjoy. There's that Alabama bookseller says that they have a hard time keeping titles trending on book talk on the on the shelves. What is your take on that?
It's good. It's a good thing. I'm not making a comment on TikTok. I don't really know what the pluses and the minuses of TikTok are, honestly. But a plus for sure is that it has turned a lot of, especially, you know, statistically younger women onto books. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing for those individuals, and it's a good thing for the stores. Yes, it is selling books, mainly in the area of romantic or romantic comedy. That's okay. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Don't be judgmental. And if people start reading more, they start branching out a little bit more. You know, we all started with very, you know, movies that were very, very popular. And as we watch more and more and more, our taste widen and broaden, and we're just more open to different kinds of films. And as people read more, they become a little bit more open to different kinds of books and
the possibilities. Yes, James Patterson and the newest one here, The Secret Lives of Booksellers and Librarians. Madeline in Green Bay is here. Madeline, hi. What would you like to say?
Well, I'd like to say that most people are not aware that most public libraries have an information desk, and you can call there and ask for a phone number or address to a company just about anywhere. And also, if you want to get some specific information about a certain topic, you just ask for the information desk, and you can get an answer to about any question that you have.
Madeline, I'm grinning because thinking about the librarians I learned who work the information desk, James, they talked about their experiences.
I'm sorry, you're asking me?
Go ahead.
No, absolutely. No, well, yeah, the questions that people have is, some of the questions people have is, it's kind of amazing. Or they'll come up with, you know, well, it's has a blue cover. Okay, can you help me out a little bit more? Yeah, that kind of thing. And it gets the older you get, like with me, the less information you have to give them. So it's definitely a trip. And there's definitely a lot of humor based around that general area.
I want to circle back to Wisconsin here for a moment. You profile the owner of Mystery Mike's in Indiana, and Mystery Mike, he goes on this book hunt for a collection in Madison, like a deceased professor. And I'm just wondering a little bit more about a story like that and these hidden finds around the country with people's personal collections.
Yeah, well, whatever turns you on. This once again gets down to this thing, what can I do most beautifully? And people have... I mean, one of the great things about libraries, obviously, that's the best place to go other than maybe Google. But libraries are better because you can go deeper there, and it's easier to get deeper. But you have a special interest. I mean, obviously, with a lot of these things like heritage and stuff like that, people, they're fascinated with where the hell they came from and what their families were like and stuff like that. And if you have that kind of curiosity, you should live in a library or certainly visit there every week. And then the bookstore, same thing. There's so much information you can get in the bookstore, so many different areas where you can, you know, if that's your interest.
Cheryl from Eau Claire called in to say they love books, of course, your books, but it is sad to see booksellers aren't as prevalent. Cheryl says they're having a hard time finding hard copy books as everything is turning digital. Is there a downturn in hard copies?
I don't think so. I mean, it depends on the city you're in, you know. I mean, there certainly are things like in New York City, there are a heck of a lot less bookstores than there used to be. But I think overall across the country, it's not down much, I don't think. Look, if your area and there's no bookstores, I mean, even we have a house in Westchester. in New York, and which is, it's pretty relatively affluent, and there's very few bookstores, which is really weird to me. So yeah, we'll see where it all goes, but it's not terrible, but it could be better.
We're about to feature the Wisconsin bookseller Holly Strong, who is part of this collection. You know, how can people make...
Another Green Bay, yeah.
Yeah. How can people...
Yeah, she's a B&N. That's an interesting thing, because we do have some B&N and some Books A Million employees. And you know what? The whole thing, there used to be this sort of battle a little bit between like Barnes & Noble and Borders and Indies. And I think that's beginning to go away a little bit. And people are just going, you know what? Let's just have people read books. It's all good. And one of the things you'll find about some of the B&N people is they're coming from the same place as the indies in terms of they want to hand sell. They want to do right by books. They're passionate about books. But I think a lot of the prejudice is, what was the bookstore thing with Sally Manhattan, with Tom Hanks and
The movie. Oh, we're going way back. Yeah.
Well, but that's where you had that big, and in those days it was a fair thing, because Barnes and Noble was coming in and trying to knock off indies. But I think, you know, now it's more peaceful, and it should be, because bookstores are a good thing. And we it's come up several times here. We definitely need more bookstores.
Mm. Well, James, this has been so wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's terrific. You're a very good host, you are.
I appreciate it. James Patterson, best-selling author, written numerous thrillers along with nonfiction books. Latest one on sale Monday, The Secret Lives of Booksellers and Librarians, True Stories of the Magic of Reading. And just ahead, we talk with one of the booksellers featured in Patterson's tribute, store manager in Green Bay, and you can join the conversation. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Texas librarian defines book joy as matching people with the books that will bring them the most happiness. And a new book captures the passion of booksellers and librarians in their own words, features a bookseller in Green Bay. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Holly Strong is an area manager at Barnes & Noble in Green Bay. Her story is part of James Patterson's new book, The Secret Lives of Booksellers and Librarians. Holly, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you so much for having me. This is awesome.
Yeah, so what was it like for you to read about yourself in the words of James Patterson?
It was very surreal. It's interesting because as a bookseller, you know how much goes into writing books. Like, you hear authors talk about their labor of love, but this process started like over 2 years ago. So to actually hold the physical book and see the words that he crafted with my interview was just so interesting and awesome.
Can you give us a bit of a preview of your story and what you said?
Sure. I mean, I talk about how I became a bookseller at Barnes & Noble. I've always wanted to work in books. I either wanted to be a teacher or work in books, and books are just my passion. So I talk about how I kind of became a bookseller. And I talk about some of my really awesome customer experiences, especially with some of my young adult customers, which I think is a community that really needs books more than most.
You talk about helping this young person who you found crying in your bookstore, and you told them that reading can help them comfort, you know, bring comfort, because many other people who have felt the same way you do now. How does reading help people find that common ground?
I mean, I think there's a lot of ways reading can help with that. I mean, you're going to be able to see other people's experiences. And if you don't have anyone in your own life that is going through the same things or has the same feelings towards something, there's always going to be a book that allows you to recognize, I'm not alone in this. And there are people that have experienced this, and people who have gone through it, or people that can help me recognize that I'm not so different after all. And, you know, I'm part of this amazing world, and it's just amazing how these books can bring people back to a sense of self and a sense of value.
Can you talk more about these young readers and the YA Readers Club that you've worked to establish?
Oh, that was so fun. That was my very first store I ever worked at. It was actually out in Canton, Connecticut. I heard the caller from Connecticut earlier. And I noticed in that store, we were really starting to get young adult books and kind of bring them to the forefront of the store. But we didn't really have any activities for that group. And they're a hard group to get to show up for activities. But I really wanted to try. So we started a book club, and I met some amazing people. They're adults now, and I'm still in touch with a couple of them. They're great people, and we've really actually Maximum Ride by James Patterson was one of our selections. I remember that being one of our picks, and it just created this safe space for them to really, again, like, find themselves. And you know, that's kind of the age where you either really find your love of reading or you could really lose it. And to give them a safe space to be like, let's talk about books, let's talk about what you love, and like talk about what your interests are, is just amazing and so fun.
I think what I learned through a number of these stories is that book selling isn't like any other type of regular retail selling where you go through a line and you get your things and you leave. Can you kind of explain how it stands apart from other retail?
I was actually just talking with some of my coworkers about this because I never wanted to work retail. That wasn't obviously a thing that I grew up saying, I want to work retail. But book retail is so different because the customer connection is just so much more. And I mean, we get to really help impact people in a way that I feel like a lot of retailers don't. And it's just a completely different experience to me. Yeah, you have the day-to-day of cleaning bathrooms and doing the things that all retailers have to do. But it doesn't feel like selling, because to me, you're really just helping them discover something that's going to either teach them or give them a story to fall in love with and kind of escape something. Or, you know, there's just so many ways that books impact. To me, it doesn't feel like retail.
We're talking with Holly Strong, Barnes & Noble store manager in Green Bay, featured in James Patterson's newest book, The Secret Lives of Booksellers and Librarians. And you can join the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. Holly, what do you make of James' observation that there isn't this tug of war really that much anymore between the chain bookstores, the larger bookstores, and these indie bookstores?
I mean, I guess personally, I was never part of that, if there was that tug of war. As a customer, I shop all bookstores, and I love going to indie bookstores, but I also feel like there's so much value and necessity to chain bookstores because they can hold a lot more stock, they can give a lot more options, and it keeps the availability of more books in the community, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's so much value in indie bookstores and they bring so much to communities. But I also think, you know, large scale bookstores just have many things that they can offer that sometimes smaller bookstores just can't. And I think they both have value in community and they both add to community. So I personally don't have any sort of war between either or. I love them both and I think they're both valuable.
How much latitude do you have in choosing what's on your shelves?
Oh, it's awesome. So we actually have tons of freedom at Barnes & Noble for what we carry. Each one of our stores kind of like an independent bookstore in a lot of ways. We get to kind of decide what books we're facing out, and our staff gets to make their, you know, staff recommendation cards. And we have folks that we can actually, you know, call up and say, we want to, you know, do this kind of display. What kind of books do you think would fit that? Because our community is really interested in this. Or, you know, if you go up to Green Bay, like, where's our Packers section?
I was about where's the Packers section?
Yeah, because really it's not a one size fits all. In bookstores, it's not like when you go into a Target and you know the pattern and the routine of like what you're going to see everywhere. Bookstores really should reflect their community, and that's what we try to do.
That's interesting. What do you make of your you know, the workers and who come to be part of your business, what brings them in to be part of your staff?
I mean, it's usually they just love books, right? They're just excited to talk to someone about books. And it's funny because I heard when you were talking to James about the woman asking, like, can you clean the bathroom? Because there are a lot of people who show up and they're like, I just love to read. And they think that's what you do all day, but there is a lot more to it. So interviews are always interesting, but it always comes back to, I just love to read and I want to be a part of that world.
And what is your hot take on Book Talk, the community on TikTok? How influential is it?
It's crazy. So in my 17 years of book selling, I've never seen something impact an audience so quickly and so much. It was like a tidal wave that hit, but it was one of the best things that could have happened to, you know, to the publishing industry, to readership. And kind of like James alluded to, yeah, there's a lot of like that pop, like romance and things that people have been interested in, but now it's transitioning into fantasy. It's transitioning into other, you know, styles of books. So it's not a tool that's just gonna help one, you know, type of author, one type of publisher. It's really expanding out and it's amazing to see.
In our final moments together, are you feeling optimistic for bookstores in the future?
I do. I mean, I feel like a community without a bookstore just is lacking a soul. So I think it's crucial that we keep doing that heavy lifting and hard work to get kids reading, to get young adults reading, and to really help them, you know, find that passion throughout life and find the right door to open to give them a story they'll love and, you know, discover that really can impact their life in such a positive way.
Holly, thank you for joining us.
No, thank you so much for having me. This was so fun.
Holly Strong is store manager at Barnes & Noble in Green Bay. Her story is part of James Patterson's newest book, The Secret Lives of Booksellers and Librarians. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.